Throughout history, Christians have created art, written books, and made music for worship, entertainment, and to express their faith in ever-increasing endeavors. And for the last six decades, they have created contemporary Christian music for the church and for the masses. Here at Legacy, we are counting down the finest works over these last decades. So join me, your host, David Lohman, as we celebrate CCM's greatest albums, right here on Legacy. Welcome to Legacy. I'm your host, David Lohman. I am so excited to be back with all of you as we continue the countdown. We also have a very special guest. His name is Luke Easter. He's a lead vocalist for the band Tourniquet. We'll be talking about one of their albums. We got a lot heading your way. 2024 is going to be a great year for Legacy. You're going to see a whole lot more shows, and we're going to have a whole lot more fun. So go ahead, hang on, and we will be right back with the countdown right here on Legacy. Here at Legacy, we want to make it easy for you to find us. There are several different ways that you can talk to us and let us know what you think about what is going on here at the podcast and also on the blog. You can always go to our website at legacyccmsgreatestalbums.com. That's legacyccmsgreatestalbums.com, or by email at legacyccmsgreatestalbums@gmail.com. You can always find us on the Facebook and interact with us there at facebook.com/legacyccmsgreatestalbums, at Instagram at legacyccmsgreatestalbums, and finally on Twitter at legacyccmsbest. Number 875. After several years of touring with bands like Santana, his own band Creation, and even Sly the Family Stone, Leon Patillo found faith and brought his music into the Christian music market with his debut album in 1979 called Dance, Children, Dance. Now, in the late 70s, early 80s, it was impossible to go to a roller skating rink without having Christian music nights. And those Christian music nights were dominated by this album and the music that was easy to skate to. One interesting little note, a lot of people think that Leon was part of Myrrh or whatever when he first came into the Christian music industry, but actually this debut album, Dance Children Dance, was released on, of all labels, Maranatha Music. Filled with legitimate R&B, soul, and some funk, Dance Children Dance has become a classic that people still go back to, including myself, year after year.
Mighty kingdom. the wisdom to see.
At number 875, that is Leon Patillo and Dance, Children, Dance. Number 874. The first of several albums from friend and singer-songwriter Michael Anderson, Love is the Hardest Part would actually be the last album recorded for the Christian music industry. If you want to learn a little bit more about the history between myself and Michael and how we go all the way back to his first A&M release, Sound Alarm, there is an earlier podcast that you can find just looking for Michael Anderson on Legacy. Michael is a brilliant singer-songwriter, but in this one, he decided to cover one of the other great singer-songwriters in Christian music history, Larry Norman. Taking his Americana soul, mixing it with Memphis soul, Love is the Hardest Part continued a great string of albums from Michael Anderson.
Behind your back.
874, that is Michael Anderson, and Love is the Hardest Part. Number 873. Truly one of the great and beautiful voices of the Jesus movement and Jesus music, this is Kelly Willard's debut album, Blame It on the One I Love.
Sometimes I'm so confused that I don't know what to do, and it's hard to find a friend can take my troubles too. I get so afraid to be myself. Tell me, who else can you be? You can't be nobody else. I need a friend so true, I can take all my troubles too. Can you tell me what?
Willard actually has this storied career performing with everyone from Dion DiMucci and Lenny LeBlanc and Amy Grant, Buddy Green, Keith Green, Fernando Ortega. She started in kind of Southern gospel music with Jake Hess, ended up moving and working with the Archers, and then finally became a member of the great group Seth. Working closely with great producer Jonathan David Brown and artists like Harlan Rogers, Willard really honed her craft, so then her debut album came out. It was like a seasoned veteran releasing a truly classic album. Kelly Willard at number 873 with Blame It on the One I Love. Number 872, Room Full of Walters and the album Sleepyhead.
Insubordinate, and I've found
Despite living relatively in obscurity, this Wichita band released a couple albums on Mercy Records, an independent label, and then finally when the third album, Sleepyhead, released, Word Records jumped in and decided to distribute it nationally, and the band became a band to watch out for. Though they would only record one more album after this one, their four albums are definitely worth tracking down, especially this one, Sleepyhead. And with the album Sleepyhead, this is Room Full of Walters and number 872. Number 871. Few bands make such an impact with their debut albums, quite like Small Town Poets.
Song number four falls on your grieving ear. Yes, I believe the peace of Christ is near, and I'm here in His name. You do the same, you do the same. If you let me close, closer than a brother. If you let me love, you will sit here and cry.
Released on Forefront Records immediately, Christian Radio kind of gravitated towards the band. They had a sound that was very contemporary and modern, yet still safe for radio, and as a result, ended up with a ton of hits.
But
down my thoughts in a letter to the president. Penciled and packaged with all due respect, Elvis commemoratives just for effect. Never heard back, think you know a guy. My congrats to Chuck and Di some time ago.
All I know is the Queen.
My invitation was lost in the mail, but I knew I was missed when they kissed me the veil. I sent a nice gift, never got a note. But my clothes is trying to end
over the years. Small Town Poets would receive Grammy nominations and Dove Awards. They were a great band that had a real sound that was very popular kind of in Georgia, and that sort of a vibe with the jangly guitars and great harmonies, killer vocals, very smart lyrics. Number 871, that is Small Town Poets with Small Town Poets. At number 870, Kansas and Drastic Measures. How great is the band Kansas? Well, considering that an album that many consider one of their weakest in their entire history is still such a phenomenal record, it deserves inclusion here on Legacy. Looking purely from the outside, I always kind of had the feeling that this was the album that Kerry Livgren was kind of distancing himself from the rest of the band and working a lot on his Christian music with Kerry Livgren AD. As a result, several of the songs were written by John and Dino Elefante, and of course we'll be talking much more about them in the future.
Oh,
though it's only the second album and the last album that would feature John Elefante on vocals, his vocals seem to fit exactly what's going on musically throughout the entire project. Even though many criticize the album of not being some of their best, it does include several songs, especially Mainstream, that really, really sets it apart as a great album. My favorite is the album closer, Incident on a Bridge.
Visions of
number 870. That is Kansas with Drastic Measures. Number 869. Randy Stonehill, Lazarus Heart. Throughout the 70s and the 80s, Randy Stonehill was a fixture in Christian music, making some of the best albums, and we'll be discussing those in the future, no doubt. But for now, I think it'd be a grave mistake to overlook his output in the 90s and into the 2000s. Lazarus Heart starts that conversation. Gone are kind of the goofy, novelty-oriented songs, and replaced with a somber, serious, and a very emotional and emotive Randy Stonehill.
Clinging to this telescope, scanning the horizon, stranded in my little boat, on the sea of dreams, running out of time and hope, searching for an island, finding every cruel mirage is never what it seems. Then I sailed to the edge of the world, and I saw your face, your
brilliant production from Jamie Lee Sloss. The album captures an artist contemplating on the most important things in life all the way throughout.
That's why we don't love. Although our lips feign praise, still our hearts are far away. That's why we don't love God. We're so consumed with self, we can't love anyone. That's why we don't love God.
At number 869, that is Randy Stonehill and Lazarus Heart. Number 868, Morella's Forest, Super Deluxe. Morella's Forest put out a demo, and then they had a little independent EP, but it was when Brandon Ebel discovered them and put them on tooth and nail that all of a sudden Morella's Forest became a band that everyone seemed to be talking about. I remember working for Diamante at the time, and Brandon introduced the band with kind of this noise pop shoegazer, said it was kind of like a female version of Starflyer 59, but with more energy, and I don't know what the different combinations of things were. All I knew is I immediately loved it. Number 868, that is Morella's Forest and Super Deluxe. Number 867, Woven Hand and the Threshing Floor. From the brainchild of David Eugene Edwards of 16 Horsepower comes Woven Hand. Kind of think of it as Appalachian rock, Americana, alternative, indie. I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can describe what is utterly brilliant music.
Sinking hands, mercy, mercy, your darkened face.
Artful, dark, creative. You can throw all these sort of adjectives at it, but the best thing to do is simply sit back and listen to the brilliant music of Woven Hand.
Who's finest in here?
There is a kind of a subtle power and passion that comes through David Eugene Edwards' music, and it really shows itself on this album, The Threshing Floor. At 867, Woven Hand, The Threshing Floor. 866, Adina Dahl, Into My Soul. Of Adina Dahl since the first time I heard Alibi. When it first released, I bought that album just because of the album cover, and then 10 years later, I'm working for Diamante, and there is an agreement to distribute bands from Europe, and the first release that we had was Adina Dahl's Into My Soul. Filled with amazing pop music, I always kind of felt they were in that kind of Hall & Oates sort of vibe all the way throughout. Unbelievable hooks, great melodies, killer vocals, awesome harmonies, and hit after hit after hit.
A picture of
One of the big selling points for the album, though, was the last song on the album, which actually ended up being a part of a contest that's very famous in Europe. The song was Like a Wind, and it did incredibly well in this European contest. And as a result, Christian radio jumped all over it, and we had a big hit on our hands. And at 866, that is Adina Dahl and Into My Soul. When we come back, we will be talking to Luke Easter of the band Tourniquet about the album Vanishing Lessons. So hang on, we'll be right back, right here on Legacy. Here at Legacy, we want to make it easy for you to find us. There are several different ways that you can talk to us and let us know what you think about what is going on here at the podcast and also on the blog. You can always go to our website at legacyccmsgreatestalbums.com. That's legacyccmsgreatestalbums.com, or by email at legacyccmsgreatestalbums@gmail.com. You can always find us on the Facebook and interact with us there at facebook.com/legacyccmsgreatestalbums, at Instagram at legacyccmsgreatestalbums, and finally on Twitter at legacyccmsbest. Welcome back to Legacy. I'm your host, David Lohman. And as I just mentioned, we will be talking to Luke Easter, who became the lead singer of Tourniquet on this album, Vanishing Lessons, that we are talking about. And I've actually got Luke on the line. Luke, how are you doing this evening?
I'm good. It's good to talk to you.
It is great to talk to you. Now, you were actually on quite a while ago, and we talked about your solo project. Before we jump into Vanishing Lessons, can you update us on maybe some new music that might be coming, or what you're working on, or what you're doing?
I am in the final stages of writing the follow-up to The Pop Disaster. I did put out a single in 21 called Mystery. But I haven't really done anything since then, recording-wise. I performed with Reign of Glory at a festival last year, and actually Guy Ritter, Gary Lanier, and I will be performing together this coming July as Stop the Bleeding, performing Tourniquet songs.
Oh, so that should be a lot. That's super cool. Is that going to be a tour? Is it just going to be a one-off show, or what's happening with that?
For the time being, it's a one-off show. There's a newer festival in Ohio called Immortal Fest.
Oh yeah,
and yeah, should be a lot of fun. I've never I've never done a show with Guy Ritter before, so I think it'll be fun.
That's true, because he left and you replaced. So
yes, sir.
And they, you know, obviously for those that are unfamiliar, Gary and Guy also have a band called Flood, which is amazing. We'll talk about them, even though the album was too, the most recent album was too new to be concluded on Legacy. It's hopefully we'll have a chance to talk with those two about Early Tourniquet as we talk about them. But for right now, we're talking about Vanishing Lessons, which was a bit of a departure of an album. It's the first album that didn't have a whole lot of words that I could not pronounce, as I was a salesperson at the time. And it was always fun to walk into a Christian bookstore and try and pronounce some of the names of the songs on previous Tourniquet albums. Had a very different look to the cover, and it had a bit of a different sound. It was, as along with being metal and traditional metal, it also had kind of a hard rock sound as well, and it featured a brand new lead vocalist named Luke Easter. So how did that all come together in the creation of that album?
So I'd been singing in a local band in the Bay Area for a couple of years, and it had kind of run its course. So I had left them, and I was trying to figure out what to do next, and I figured my choices were to either take the next step and climb the ladder a little bit or cut my hair and go to school. So I was trying to figure out, you know, what to do. Did I start something else? Did I, you know, join an established thing or whatever? And Brian Gray from The Blamed, he's another Bay Area guy. Mm-hmm. And his old band, Rocks and Pink Cement, used to play shows here and there with my old band. And he told me, you know, you need to try out for Tourniquet. I'm like, I don't think that would work because, I mean, my taste. I mean, I liked metal. I owned, you know, the three Tourniquet records at the time. But all of my experience was a lot more commercial, a lot more mainstream. And he kept telling me, no, you should go for it. You should go for it. You know, I can hook you up with them and, you know, whatever. So I took a flyer and was like, what's the worst that can happen? I can get an audition, meet some guys that I'm a fan of, and hopefully that gets me some traction and maybe I find something else. So I sent them a tape, and a couple weeks after that, I was in LA for an audition, and I got home like the day after the audition, drove back to the Bay Area from LA, and had been home a couple hours and got a phone call telling me that I was it, I was the guy, and asking if I could be back in LA the following week. So a week after the audition, I was in LA rehearsing, and a week after that, we were in a town outside of Tulsa, and I was playing the biggest show I'd ever played in my life and kicking off the Pathogenic tour.
Wow. that's incredible. And you toured as part of Pathogenic Ocular Dissonance,
yes,
which we'll discuss later on the podcast, probably in a year or so. But they would then soon go into a studio to record Vanishing Lessons. I guess from the outside, again, looking, I was just a rep, I was just a fan. It seemed to have a directional difference, compared to the previous projects musically. There was significantly a lot more hard rock, with it. Bearing Gruesome Cargo, the song that starts off the album, has that really cool acapella kind of thing that kicks things off. Was this something that you had influence? Was it just a direction Ted was going, the band was going? How did that all kind of merge, and was it happening? What was happening musically at the time?
I think it was a lot of different factors. They'd pretty much pushed the envelope as far as I shouldn't say they, because I was part of it by that point. The envelope had been pushed as far as it could kind of go in the heavy side of things with Pathogenic. I mean, there wasn't really anywhere more to go in terms of being heavier. And the industry was, you know, shifting a little bit. The Black Album had come out, you know, Metallica's Black Album, and had kind of paved the way for heavier bands to do something that was a little more song oriented, a little more groove oriented, and less thrashy, less heavy. And I think the fact that, you know, I was the new guy, and it's like, well, you know, we have a whole new palette vocally that we can work with. Let's just do this. So, I mean, it wasn't contrived, but I know that there was some thought put into the approach. But it, like with everything that we did over the years, it was no, you know, grand design to it. It was just, you know, this feels right. This is what I think we want to do now. So we're just going to do this now. We're this band.
Yeah. I was going to say, but years and years ago, I learned a lesson between what I thought were great albums, what I thought were my favorite albums. And I kind of separated the two from a critic's point of view, from a fan's point of view. I think there are different albums. And I will say, though, I think that the first couple albums may be in their own ways a little superior, Vanishing Lessons is still the album I listen to the most. For me, it's the most accessible. It has songs that I think sound as cool today as they did 20 plus years ago. I think there's something about this album that kind of stands out that made it so unique from what everything else that was going on musically at the time. So interestingly enough, it's still going to be my favorite album. For you, when you guys go out and you play and you tour and you record this album, is there a conscious decision to, you know, find a hook or a something that, hey, maybe, you know, Christian rock radio might even touch? Because I know that this was one of the first times where, like, wow, we could, as a sales rep, it was like, oh, we could really push something even to radio stations with the Baring Gruesome Carbogo and stuff that had this more melodic feel to it. Did you guys feel that in the band, or was it just something that just appears?
Again, I wasn't part of the writing on that record. I mean, I had input in terms of you know, stylizing it once we were in the studio, and, you know, had some input. Like Baring Gruesome Cargo was a lot faster paced. Ted heard it in his head a little bit more like Nobody's Fault But Mine from Zeppelin.
Okay.
But he was a drummer and, you know, wrote vocal phrases the way that it sounded, you know, in his drummer mind, and then I get in the booth and try and sing it, and if I can't sing that, there's nowhere to breathe. You know, so there was things like that, but not being part of the writing, I can't say definitively, but knowing how we worked when I was writing and as things progressed, we never wrote for radio. We were conscious of it, and we knew that the label would want something to deliver to radio, but we just approached it as we're going to write the best songs we can. And I'm, you know, pretty sure that was the approach for Ted and Gary. They wrote the bulk of that record. That it was, you know, radio was a secondary thing. And when we wound up charting and doing well with Twilight, there was nothing else on the record to push to Christian radio.
Yeah, and Twilight did really well.
It did really well. And that was the first time. I mean, we'd always done well on like the rock and metal charts, but that was the first time we actually made like the, you know, Christian, you know, I'm not even sure what the designation is anymore, but just normal mainstream radio. And so then there was this mad dash to record something quickly to follow it up. And so we retooled My Promise. And that was what followed Twilight at rock radio.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, as bands go through transitions, what I never got, which is funny because Metallica got it and a lot of other bands got it, was this like sellout. And I don't think I ever heard that from Tourniquet fans. Tourniquet fans seem to accept musical differences, and I think over the 25 years of the band's existence, there's been a lot of changes. Even though there's kind of this undercurrent that is consistent, that it didn't seem like anyone was selling out to hit radio. It's like, oh, this is what we're writing at the time. And I think that comes across as a listener and as a fan. I think it's one of the reasons you can go back and listen to Pathogenic Ocular Dissonance or Stop the Bleeding or even listen to Vanishing Lessons and find the quality in each one of those albums. It must be something that as a band or as a singer or whatever, that you kind of have to be proud of, that it was just based on the art that was being created.
We were fortunate. I mean, there was a small, but, you know, they were vocal, but it was a really small contingency of people that, you know, thought we had sold out or that, you know, we were, you know, pandering to radio or whatever, or being told what to do by the label. But the reality is we were blessed to have almost complete autonomy. We didn't, you know, submit songs to A&R. We didn't, you know, hand in a record and then, you know, sit anxiously waiting to find out if the label was going to put it out. Our deal was that we make the rec, and so we were free to kind of follow, for want of a better word, our follow our muse. And so there was very little we did that was contrived. Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything, honestly, that was, you know, super thought out in terms of, oh, if we do this, then this will happen and, you know, we'll look amazing.
Yeah. It's literally, I think you guys were working, if I remember correctly, I think you guys are working with Matt. With Matt Duffy.
With Duffy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's probably the least like overbearing human on the planet. I could never picture him coming into a studio and saying, you can't do this. You have to change. I mean, that's just not the way things operated with Matt.
I think the first time that I saw Matt in the studio was when we did Carry the Wounded, the EP that we followed up Vanishing Lessons with. Yeah. And that's only because it was literally right next door to the label offices. You know, you walk across the park, there was Matt's office, but no, Duffy was always, you know, super cool. He was always very supportive. You know, if he wasn't sure if something was working, he would say so, but you know, it was never like a, you better change this or else type of thing. It was, you know, just, he believed in us and allowed us to be us, you know, for better or worse. I mean, if everything had gone horribly, that would have been on us as much as, you know, if it, you know, went down like a house on fire.
Yeah. And I think it was even before that and before you were part of the band, I think that Ted Kirkpatrick had a lot of freedom when it was Mike McLean and Brian Tong at Frontline Records.
Totally.
There never seemed to be this kind of thing that there was an expectation from the label. And then, you know, to follow up with something like the Carry the Wounded is unique. So anyway, I promised I'd make this quick and I'm going to hold myself to that promise, but I appreciate you kind of jumping on to talk about this album. Are there any things, any stories, any things you'd love to talk about that before we go? About the making of that album or what Tourniquet maybe meant to you and helped in terms of your musical career, the direction or what you were doing at the time?
That album was a lot of firsts. I mean, it was my first time making a record. It was my first time in a legitimate studio. We recorded that at Rumbo Recorders in Van Nuys, Canoga Park. Captain and Tennille still owned it at the time. I have a video somewhere of Ted playing ping pong with the captain from Captain and Tennille. We were in one room, Firehouse was in the other room, and Mike Klink was in the other room with, I forget the name of the band, they were from Canada, but you know, all the Guns N' Roses guys that weren't named Axl were in and out of that room all the time working on that record with him. I learned everything. I got to work with Jim Faraci, who had been Bo Hill's engineer and worked on all the early Rat records that I loved. So, I mean, I couldn't have been happier if I was twins, but I learned how records were made. I learned, what areas I needed to focus on if I was going to get better and if I was going to continue working. And I also got a lot of good encouragement from Jim, in terms of what, abilities and what qualities I already had and that I brought to the table. It's going to sound really cliched, but it was magical. I mean, I was 23 years old and getting to do something that I'd been dreaming about since like middle school and got to, you know, ride it out for another, you know, 20 years or so after that. And honestly, still, I mean, I'm still writing and recording. So, Vanishing Lessons, well, joining the band, but definitely making Vanishing Lessons really set all of that in motion and reaffirmed that I had made the right decision and that I really was pursuing something that I love.
And what's amazing to me is that, you know, you just mentioned that this was a bunch of firsts. It must have been nice to have a bunch of firsts with some of the most phenomenal musicians in the industry. I mean, it was I don't know, when people look at things from the outside, they don't realize just really how incredibly talented the musicians that made up Tourniquet were.
I mean, reconnecting with Gary and, you know, talking with him more recently and stuff now, I still am like, what, how did I get in that room? You know, I know that I can do the job. I can sing okay. I can sing on pitch. I can work a crowd, but you know, there's still a part of me that's like, how did I get in that room? Cause they're like really, really good. And I'm me. And I mean, I'm okay. I'm not saying that I'm, you know, awful, but you know, coming into it as somebody who had been a fan of the band, and then making a record. Yeah. I was very much aware of, you know, wow, how did I get here?
Well, again, thank you so much for joining me on this quick notice. Look forward to future conversations with you. And for those who are listening, hang on. When we come back, we'll talk a bit more about the album. But I'd like just like to say thanks to Luke Easter as we discuss Tourniquet's Vanishing Lessons. So we'll be right back right here on Legacy. Here at Legacy, we want to make it easy for you to find us. There are several different ways that you can talk to us and let us know what you think about what is going on here at the podcast and also on the blog. You can always go to our website at legacyccmsgreatestalbums.com. That's legacyccmsgreatestalbums.com, or by email at legacyccmsgreatestalbums@gmail.com. You can always find us on the Facebook and interact with us there at facebook.com/legacyccmsgreatestalbums, at Instagram at legacyccmsgreatestalbums, and finally on Twitter at legacyccmsbest. Number 865, Tourniquet, Vanishing Lessons. Thanks again to my guest, Luke Easter, who shared a lot about this album. I just want you to have a chance to hear a little bit. Of course, as we discussed, Twilight did become a hit for the band, and about the only time you'll ever hear them on regular Christian radio, at least back in the day. at 865. That is Tourniquet, Vanishing Lessons. Once again, a very special thanks to my guest and friend, Luke Easter from Tourniquet, talking with us about the album Vanishing Lessons and about how he joined the band. And wow, the conversation was great. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Again, thank you for joining me. I hope you're enjoying the program. Always feel free to send us a note on the Facebook page. Always like to hear from you, like to hear comments about the podcast, and also like to hear what you think about the different albums being reviewed. So, we are making a promise to deliver more podcasts as 2024 rolls along, so join me next time.
See.